America in step for victory. America marshaling its energies for war. American soldiers at the front. A great civilian army lending them support behind the lines. Yes, the American people are determined that nothing shall stand in the way of total victory. Patriotically, they are rationing their goods and resources to make huge bomber fleets, great tank corps, mighty battle squadrons available to our young men in the Army and Navy. Americans know that the sacrifices they are making on the home front are small compared to the sacrifices of the men on the battlefront.
Fred McDonald and I don't quite know who that actual announcer is, but clearly he's a good announcer from the days of World War II. Fred McDonald is my guest tonight, as he has been many times in the past, simply an historian who knows more about American broadcasting, both radio and television, has done whole books on in both of those areas, and many other significant volumes, all concerned with American broadcasting. And you are here, are you not?
I am here, and happy to be here.
But we don't know who that fellow was, but what's the significance of that announcement?
That is from early 1942, and it really shows you the attempt by radio to rally public opinion. Now, you might think, oh, well, after we were attacked, everybody was in favor of war. But this had a country had a deep America first isolationist history. Many people, most people sympathized with the British, but they didn't want to go to war.
One of the people who led and energized that America first movement sat in an office at the top of the very building where we now are broadcasting.
Oh, no, who that's Colonel McCormick?
Colonel Robert McCormick, who was a great isolationist until the attack at Pearl Harbor and then changed completely.
But you also had a situation where the war was declared on the United States by Germany and Italy a few days after Pearl Harbor. So now you had a two-front war. And there are historical arguments that say without the Germans and the Italians declaring war first, it would have been difficult for Roosevelt to have argued for a two-front war.
Yes. When Roosevelt goes to Congress and calls for a declaration of war, it's a declaration of war against, as he calls it, the Empire of Japan.
Absolutely.
But nothing concerning Germany or Italy.
No, they did a favor, as it were, to their ally in Japan by declaring war on the enemy.
Now, we're loaded with clips, that all chosen by you, and as usual, I'm totally in your debt for this. And the second one coming up, I'm struggling to find it. Yes, indeed, is the Pearl Harbor attack. Now, we've got two different broadcasts here. Do you want to explain, or should we just go to it?
We'll hear the first one very quickly, the NBC announcement, and then you will actually hear the New York Philharmonic playing Shostakovich Symphony No. 1. And as it comes to an end, or as it's coming to an end, you find out about the war, and as it comes to an end, they give up Deems Taylor discussing the classical music, and they talk about what just happened.
And this is a more lengthy clip, about 3 minutes, and this is how war comes to America, or comes to the consciousness of America, as they're listening to the radio.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The Symphony No. 1 in F minor by the modern Russian composer Shostakovich performed as the opening work on this afternoon's Philharmonic program, Arthur Rudzinski conducting. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and Manila, the Philippine Islands, from the air. The attack is developing. Today, Deems Taylor's usual commentary will be replaced by a further report on the Far Eastern situation. We pause now for 15 seconds. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines. The first disclosure of this news was made by Presidential Secretary Stephen Early by telephone at approximately 2:25 in Washington. I read the text of this historic announcement at a little after 2:30. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air, and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. That was Secretary Early's message. Short while later, he dictated another message. A second air attack has been reported. This one has been made on the Army and Navy bases in Manila. And here's a last-minute Associated Press flash from Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against the Pearl Harbor defenses. Secretary Early informed all correspondents and then rushed to the White House to be with President Roosevelt. As the announcement was made, the two Japanese envoys, Ambassador Nomura and Special Emissary Kurosu, were at the State Department. Columbia's correspondent in London, Bob Trout, heard the news for the first time from our report from New York. Up to that moment, or very shortly before then, the British capital had not been informed of the Japanese attack on the Hawaiian Islands and on Manila. In view of Prime Minister Churchill's recent pledge that a British declaration of war on Japan would follow almost immediately upon the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, a British announcement is expected soon. Columbia's correspondent, Ford Wilkins, was put on the air in CBS's regular 2:30 news program on Sunday afternoon from Manila. He was cut off the air suddenly while he was talking about air raid shelters, possibly because of censorship. In communication with Columbia's radio station, KGMD in Honolulu.
That's incredible material. I've never heard that before.
You can imagine, though, there has been great tension in the country for years. Mm-hmm. Since the war broke out in Europe in September of 1939, in Far East, the Japanese invasion of China, well, you can go back to Manchuria in 31 and China in 36. I mean, there's some great tension. The War of the Worlds broadcast in October of 38, that Orson Welles' famous one that scared the country.
When the Martians invaded. Yeah.
What scared them, of course, was the tension that was in the air anyway about an enemy invasion. Now it's coming from Mars. So here now it's broken. The Japanese have attacked us. There's loss of life. We don't know what's going to happen. There's a fear running through people, a patriotism. And these broadcasts should bring home to your listeners just the power of the medium of radio in bringing this to their ears.
And one must remember immediately that happens on December 7th, as we well know. And the next afternoon,
a major day
before Congress, Franklin Delano Roosevelt speaks.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after, Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack.
And he goes on to ask for a declaration of war, which, of course, he gets. One member of Congress holds out.
One vote against war by a pacifist.
Yeah.
And
a woman from either the state of Washington or Oregon, and I forget her name, but she was well known for this particular action.
Maybe one of your callers will come up.
Oh, undoubtedly. We'll hear that supplied to us later on from one of our callers. Right now, we are due for a quick round of commercials. We're going to be interspersing these sound clips, these voice clips of many kinds, with the music of the war as well, the American side of the musical war, because there were great songs, not only in Britain and in Russia, but indeed also the Nazis had some rather good tunes.
I don't whistle them very often. No. I don't know if they'd make our charts.
But we'll come to American music, just as bumps, as they say, introducing the next segment, and the next segment will begin right after these words.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty.
I guess they turned those out pretty quickly when they needed them.
Tin Pan Alley came to the rescue.
Yeah.
There was a big discussion over what we want a song like Over There, remember, from World War One, and they could never come really up with it. I mean, early on, the Star Spangled Banner was on the hit parade and things like that, but the Marines' hymn, the caissons go marching along and rolling along. But it took them a while to really get into the spirit to come up with a war song, if there was such a thing as the Over There of World War II.
I don't know that there what particular one of the many American war songs from World War II would have that same significance.
Well,
there isn't one that really stands out as the song of the war.
If I had to choose one that was specifically a war song, I've seen adult students of mine cry, tear up rather, when Kate Smith sang "God Bless America."
Uh-huh. And that was done by Irving Berlin.
Back in the World War One era.
Way back,
It was in his trunk, and he brought it out in the late 30s and gave it to Kate Smith.
Back to the radio record. Radio geared up. There was no television. It was experimentally possible, but it had not yet been commercially mounted.
There was not television that we could even recall. Although the first regular broadcast did begin at the World's Fair in 1939.
Uh-huh. We've got, coming next, This Is War, a segment, it says here, from a four-network broadcast. Tell us about that.
This is a drama by the greatest radio writer, Norman Corwin.
Still with us, you tell me.
Still alive, close to 100 years old, if not older than 100. But Norman Corwin wrote this piece, and it is all four networks simultaneously broadcasting it in February of 1942, and it's indicative of the notion that the government has now is coordinating all of the networks to become a major force for propaganda. They have to keep morale high on the home front. They have to keep things like strikes. In other words, they were having shipping strikes on the West Coast when the war broke out. How do you get the workers back in and forget their demands and go for the whole war without getting a raise? They have to keep the morale going, and the way you do that is to get the four networks, NBC, Blue and Red, CBS and the Mutual Network, to be cooperative with the messages you want to send. And the Office of Facts and Figures, run by then by Archibald MacLeish, is the main organizing institution.
And they called it the Office of Facts and Figures.
They later changed it to the OWI.
Over in Germany, they called it the Propaganda Ministry.
That was what it was. The Office of War Information, it became, of course, with... Anyway, this is their first attempt at sending out the message, we're at war, we're one big country, and listen, allies, we're coming over, we are going to be the workshop of the arsenal of democracy.
And here's an extended excerpt, about 2.5 minutes.
You hear that? That's a new airplane motor idling on the test block. When it gets going, it turns faster than any motor ever built. Just how fast is a military secret. We can't show you the motor, but we can let you in on the sound of it. Hear that, Americans? That's the first of 100,000 noises like it. Hear that, London? We're making enough to go round. Hear that, Moscow? It flies wonderfully well in cold weather. Hear that, Chongqing? That sound is a new American slogan. Hear that, Batavia, Melbourne, Cairo, Ottawa? A lot of friendly horsepower there.
Did you hear it too, Adolf? Did your listening posts catch the sound? Of course they did. The boys will give you a report tomorrow morning. Something about hearing a secret new plane. Wait till you see it, Adolf. Did you hear it too, Benito? Did it come through clearly on the monitor at 3XL? By the way, how are you sleeping these nights, Duce? Any conscience trouble? Ever dream of getting stabbed in the back? Ever wonder what you've done to the people of Italy? Were you listening too, son of heaven? Did the vulgar motor ruffle the imperial tranquility? Did it cause to flutter the wings of the dove of peace, where brooding he perched in the garden of the temple? So sorry, Your Majesty. Honorable mistake. Americans and all you allies of Americans, you know the record and you know the facts. You know where we stood and where we stand. We didn't want this war, but now we've got it and we're going to hang on to it. Anybody who thinks we're fooling and that we're fighting a popgun war with Sundays and holidays off and business as usual has two more guesses coming. We've tasted blood and we've shed some blood, and there will be more of both. There will also be anger, and there will be the solemn word and the parting of the loved one, and the troop ship slipping away in the dark, and at home the machine turning and the flaming forge, and the weapons coming out clean, and the work going on by day and the work going on by night, until the big job's done, until the big job's done and over with and finished, so it'll stay that way.
He wrote a great sort of poetic line.
Oh, he did a program on poetry in the late 30s. Yes, he was a poet and a man who knew how to get emotion into his words powerfully.
And I think I identified two of the voices. The first voice, I think, was the great film actor of that period, Frederick March. And then I think the second was Robert Montgomery.
Yes, I'm sure of the Robert Montgomery, and it most likely was Frederick March, because he was very much involved in making propaganda radio broadcasts in early 1942. And like many of the, like most of Hollywood, throughout the war effort, lending his talents as a morale builder.
I remember not too many years after the war, John Ford made one of his great films called They Were Expendable, about PT boats. And the commander in the PT boat in the Philippine area, just as the war begins, is played by Robert Montgomery.
Who was a naval officer.
Was he actually in the war?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And as again, so many Hollywood stars did, like Clark Gable and others.
Fascinating stuff. Explain, you had the largest archive of old radio material and of television and of newsreels and everything, which you maintained and serviced broadcasters all over the world, BBC, NBC here in the country, et cetera, et cetera. And you closed it out a while ago.
In December, we sold our entire archive to the Library of Congress, which is a sort of crowning achievement.
It is indeed.
It is now next to Thomas Jefferson's library. They have the Leslie W. and J. Fred and Leslie W. MacDonald collection. And it is a massive collection of, that is 40 years of collecting films and radio and other artifacts of American mass culture.
During much of the time that you were doing this, you were also, it should be mentioned for those who haven't heard you before on this program, though you've been on this program many times, you were also a professor of history at Northeastern Illinois University.
Yeah, I started there in 1969 and got my first film from the Rather Corporation, an episode of The Lone Ranger, because I was going to teach a course that no historian had ever taught before, which was the history of American mass culture, or history through the study of American mass culture.
One of your first books was A History of American Radio. Was the title Don't Touch That Dial?
Don't Touch That Dial.
Fibber McGee's famous line.
No, it was the opening to Dagwood and Blundy.
Dagwood and Blundy.
Yeah, and but it was, that came out in 1979, and a few other books on television history and radio came out, and then I moved into other areas of publishing.
And other areas of essentially public entertainment.
Yes, yes.
Media,
The two I wrote, history education books are... is a story about a little boy who thinks he's really sharp at history because he has a memory. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that's insufficient. He has to learn from an old professor at the history shop how historians think and how they analyze.
If one went to Amazon and entered Fred McDonald, MacDonald, all of these books would pop up.
All of them except the two history education. They are on my website. They're totally free. And they're downloadable, and they have videos in them.
And your website is?
jfredmacdonald.com.
Great. And this is WGN Radio in Chicago, and we're a bit overdue for the update on the news, and for that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
You're a sap, Mr. Jap, to make a Yankee cranky. You're a sap, Mr. Jap, Uncle Sam is gonna spanky. Wait and see before we're done. The A, B, C, and D will sink your rising sun. You're a sap, Mr. Jap, you don't know Uncle Sammy when he fights for his rights. You'll take it on the lammy, for he'll wipe the axis right off a map. You're a sap, 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 Mr. Jap.
That's one I've never heard before.
It was one of those very early in the war, roughly January, February 42 ditties that Tin Pan Alley churned out to try to build up confidence and to try to capture the confidence. Those people that were going to recruiting stations saying, we'll be back before Christmas. And
it partly coincides, doesn't it, with the kind of image that during those war years was projected of the Japanese, a caricature of an ugly fellow with horn-rimmed glasses and fangs, virtually, certainly very extended incisor teeth, and sometimes dripping, and evil incarnate. We never did that to our enemy on the other side of the war. We never did that to the Germans.
And we certainly didn't do it to the Italians.
Yeah.
Or to the Bulgarians, the Romanians, the Hungarians, the Thais.
All of whom were well represented in the American population.
All those countries declared war on the United States, too.
Yeah.
But no, we didn't have the racist angle. In fact, because there were so many Germans in this country, 25% of the people, they felt, if they had been
our German derivation, yes, possibly.
They would, it was the Hitler gang, the Nazis. These were the brutes, yeah. Not the Germans, the Nazis. And so you get early in the war, you get this kind of confident, peppy, zippy songs. When the war drags on, you don't see those kind of songs.
Of course, we're gonna, let's do a little medley of three of those better known songs, better known than You're a Sap, Mr. Jap. And the first one was cocky indeed, and it's Spike Jones, in der Führer's face.
And it comes from a Donald Duck cartoon.
Originally,
Donald in Nutsy Land, yeah. And that was about October of 42 or September of 42.
Here it is together with two other equally well-known war songs of that period.
When the Führer says, "Wie ist der Master Ace?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So wie heil, heil! right in the purest place. When her Goebbels says, behold the world in space, be Heil, Heil, right in her Goebbels face.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
Don't go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't go walking down Lover's Lane with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Now, instantly one would need to ask, I'm sure lots of people are wondering, what is White Christmas doing in there?
War songs don't have, war songs or popular music in general can capture public mood.
Mm-hmm.
And by the late 1942 period, and this comes out in a movie written by Irving Berlin, the man who wrote God Bless America, and it is so popular.
The movie is called Holiday Inn.
Holiday Inn.
And then a firm called the Holiday Inn developed using that particular designation. And it's still there, is it not?
Yes. Yeah. I was it in Vermont or somewhere? And
originally,
the,
yes.
Yeah. And the but the no, this song becomes the number one song in America so rapidly. Mm-hmm. And every Christmas thereafter,
we still hear it every Christmas. Yes.
Oh, it is a, you know, it's a tradition, but it really captures the anxiety, the loneliness, the pain, the nostalgia that people on both sides of the equation, the soldiers overseas, the families back home, the nation in general, must have had, well, obviously did have, for the absence of these millions of men. So over 16 million men and women were in the armed forces in World War II. And that 16 million families didn't have somebody there for a Christmas. And this speaks to the pain, the human longing. Whereas you get Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, which is about romantic love, fidelity. Don't mess around with somebody else because I won't mess around. And Der Fuhrer's Face fits in exactly with we're going to have to slap the dirty little Jap, and Uncle Sam's the guy who can do it, or the song we heard about the A, B, C, and D will sink your rising sun. The A, Americans, B, British, C, Chinese, D, Dutch. We're all going to get together and beat the Japanese. That kind of cocky confidence fades, and you get much more thereafter the human longing in war songs.
Explain how the Dutch get into that.
The Dutch East Indies were captured in by April of 1942. Yeah. And
what is now Indonesia, basically.
Indonesia, exactly. And you heard in an earlier broadcast reports about, rather, the This Is War broadcast. They were talking about Batavia. Batavia was the Dutch capital of the Dutch East Indies. They were very much a target of the Japanese expansion.
Meanwhile, what's happening as the country gears up for war? What are the numbers? What's going on in terms of recruitment and draft and industry, et cetera, et cetera?
You had no trouble drafting, because you had
a wave of patriotism and mm-hmm. naive. They thought it was going to end quickly, that, you know, these guys did this and we're going to go over there and bop them. They'll be so easy, because they kind of bought into those simian stereotypes of the Japanese that were ours. What you really have going on here is a battle of two great imperial powers, New America, New Japan. Who's going to control that lake called the Pacific Ocean? And the Japanese, who have only become westernized since the 1860s, and they have adopted a lot of the American ways. They sent a lot of their admirals off to Annapolis to learn how to, or their sailors to become admirals. They have already beaten the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904, and they are going to take over. They're like a great prosperity sphere. They're going to become the masters of the Pacific.
And any one of a dozen films about American prisoners of war in Japan, there's always the moment when the lead prisoner of war is talking to the commandant of the Japanese war camp, and he says, "I studied at your UCLA in Los Angeles."
Or UCRA.
UCRA. Yeah, to make,
and
to
it
make
was usually Chinese actors who were playing those Japanese.
Yes. Yes.
But on the other hand, the Americans have moved out into Hawaii, have taken over Hawaii as a territory. They took Guam and the Philippines. They fought a war against Aguinaldo and the Philippine nationalists to control the Philippine Islands. And that's pretty close to the Japanese sphere. And so you've got this tension that's going on anyway. And once the war breaks out, it becomes us against them. And you have no trouble getting the coordination you need early on.
How do we build up the army? What are the numbers? What did we have in? How many men did we have in uniform on December 7th? How quickly did we expand to what level?
Well, by the end of the war, there were over 16 million people in all branches of the armed forces. There were the Americans had four foreign bases. Four bases outside the territory of the United States, you know, like Honolulu would have been a uh-huh. base, and a base in Puerto Rico. That's all they had. When the war ended, they had hundreds of them, and they didn't leave them. They maintained those bases, and that's the power we are today, is really established there. And coincident with it, of course, is the collapse of the British Empire, the French Empire, the Japanese Empire.
So what were the production requirements? We had to gear up to produce tanks, ammunition, airplanes, new great ships, carriers particularly, but also battleships. What was achieved and how quickly was it achieved?
It was very quickly achieved, because they simply took over certain industries like the automobile industry.
Uh-huh.
And Detroit turned out tanks. Detroit turned out Jeeps. Detroit turned out rolling weapons. You had other, even corset factories became factories to create parachutes.
While we're listening to music, a quick request to my friends in the booth. Let us go to number 16 on the main list. Speaking of people drawn into production, here is none other than Rosie the Riveter.
The girls attend their favorite cocktail bar, sipping martinis, munching caviar. There's a girl who's really putting them to shame. Rosie is her name.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie, the riveter, Rosie got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production E, she was as proud as a girl can be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie, the riveter.
In January of 1942, the U.S. Department of Labor reported that there were 2.8 million women now engaged in war work. By the time the war ended, 19 million women
had left their homes to become something new, working women, working in all sorts of industry, heavy industry, light industry. It was a new world they were creating.
And that world, of course, opened up beyond the war. The feminist revolution, one might say, begins with World War II. Or is renewed with World War II.
It is really reinvigorated and refocused. I mean, winning the vote is the great achievement of the early years of
the World
the 20th
War
century.
I period, yeah. In fact. Yeah.
But now it's much different. And there may be 19 million women who experienced it, but there were over 750,000 women who didn't go back to home. They stayed working after the war. So it becomes a transitional period, a revolutionary period for women's rights.
And can you name, sir, the first female general in the armed forces? Gotcha.
Yeah, you do.
Ovita Culp Hobby, am I right?
Well, she was the first head of the Women's Army
the WACS,
Corps,
yeah.
The WACS. It started out as a WAAC, and then a few months later it was changed to WAC, Women's Army Corps.
But she became general.
I didn't know she became a general.
I
know
she's
an airport down in Texas now, and Eisenhower's head of the Treasury, or head of the she signed all the dollar bills in the 1950s.
We're late for some commercials, of course, and we'll go on with this way of sampling on Memorial Day, as our way of commemorating Memorial Day, the most demanding war that we ever fought. Though, interestingly, am I right in this? We lost fewer men in World War II than we did in the Civil War.
True, because everybody on both sides in the Civil War.
It's about 400,000 deaths, American deaths, in World War II. It's 600,000 for the Civil War.
Right, because both sides, you would add them together. Of course.
The Confederacy and the Union, of course. Directly back after these words.
Women of America, march with Uncle Sam's army. Join the WAC. Aerial photographs must be developed and printed before their full value can be realized. As an air WAC, you can become a laboratory technician and do this highly skilled work.
There's a job meant for you, and the job you can do. Join the Women's Army Corps today.
Speaking of the WACS, that's a recruiting song for the WACS.
That's right. And they had, I think their quota was 150,000 women. And they began building up their units in the middle of 1941 as the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps. And then they just became, by early in 42, the Women's Army Corps, which is today we have women in combat. In those days, they weren't in combat.
Of course.
In Afghanistan and in Iraq.
They were developing photos. That's what we heard.
Well, they also did other. They flew airplanes and things that were done stateside that sent another man off to combat.
The little bit of music we heard was by Glenn Miller.
Well, Glenn Miller and his orchestra, joined the Army Air Corps Band.
Shot down in a plane.
Shot down
during the war.
There's still a lot of controversy over whether he was shot down by friendly fire or not. But he was flying from England over to France to perform, and the plane never made it.
Yeah, we have next a piece that you are eager to play, and I know nothing about it, but it has a Chicago connection apparently.
The Treasury Star Parade is one of the most amazing little 15-minute propaganda shows that was meant to sell war bonds on American radio. It was made by the government with movie actors of the highest renown and great musicians, and all of it donated free. The records were sent throughout the country to any radio station to want to play them as many times as they wanted to. But it also sold the war. And in this particular piece with the actor Henry Hull doing a monologue, he is reading or he's dramatizing a piece written by a man named Howard V. O'Brien, who wrote for the Chicago Daily News. And on January 8th, he wrote this emotional piece about saying goodbye to his son who was going off to war. And this is a short clip from the 15-minute program that gives you the essence of what it must have been like for a father, a mother, a family, to say goodbye, to send their son off to what fate nobody
knew.
This
is January 8th, 42, so it's just 1 month after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely, and it's powerful.
But we don't seem to have it. I don't know what the problem is, but that should be, I'm sorry, number 7 on our list, or number 19 on the original list, a failure on my part. And Aubrey Mumpower is rapidly pulling things together.
And as I stood there in my attic, my brain full of the voices that had come alive out of my son's past, I could hear other voices, strange, fanatic voices, crying across the sea.
America is soft, degenerate. Democracy is outmoded, outworn. The youth of America have no ideals, no enthusiasm. The youth of America is soft, degenerate.
America! The youth of America, degenerate or soft? No. I've looked into my son's eyes. I've heard his voice. Without peace and freedom, what good is living? Why the whisperings in my quiet attic ring clearer and stronger in the world than all of the shouted fanaticism, the screaming nationalism, the diving of planes and the roar of guns and churning of great ships in the sea. All their voices are quiet. All their departures are without drama. And that's just the way it should be. Their enemies were trained for war and victory. Our boys were trained for peace. But theirs is the greater strength, the greater courage, because it grows out of themselves and their own firm realization of the task before them. When these others fail, when they find they are not invincible, when that happens, the strength of men who want peace is the greater strength, and their quiet whispering in 10 million homes, the strongest voice in the world. My son has gone to war. Well, Curlyhead, you're a man now. I hated to see you go, but I wouldn't have halted you. No, not if I could. I can't pretend I'm not sad, but I'm proud, too. So long, son.
I'd never heard that before.
Oh, it is strong. The series had wonderful performances like this many times, but this is one of the best. And it's a father giving up his son to do what millions of sons did at that time. And it grabs me. Anyway, it grabs me.
The ultimate reality of war is quite simple. People get killed
And people kill in large numbers.
They do indeed.
Even for the survivors, that's very dramatic. There is a historian who writes about the realities of war.
Yeah.
And the realities are, well, we won't discuss them here, but they're very, very apatriotic. Not unpatriotic. Apatriotic. They say there's no atheists in foxholes. I don't think there are many nationalists waving flags in Hawaii. That's very scary, scary stuff.
Yeah. And that's represented in all sorts of reports, whether straight nonfiction reportage or with great novels. For example, Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage is a perfect exemplification of the horror of war and cowardice, that is, fear overcoming the soldier who enters with patriotic fervor.
You take one, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Another.
Same kind of theme.
Written on the German side in World War I by Erich Maria Remarque. Isn't that his name?
Right. Married to Gene Tierney for a while.
I didn't know that.
He was in with that whole pacifistic liberal group in the early 30s.
Time for an update on the news and then right back to World War II as waged by and for America. And we now go to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Praise the Lord that has the ammunition. Praise the Lord that has
Now, that's a well-known song from the war. I think it needs some explanation. It refers to a real incident, supposedly.
Early in 1942, it wasn't Pearl Harbor, but was shortly thereafter, there was a chaplain aboard a ship being attacked by the Japanese, and he supposedly said, you know, to rally them and to suggest that God was on their side, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
The sky pilot said. Sky pilot means the chaplain.
Exactly. And it was picked up by a Tin Pan Alley songwriter and became a national phrase and a very popular song.
Now, we're going into the war and into a very, very difficult moment in the war, namely the taking of the Bataan Peninsula. That's quite early on.
Yes,
is it February or March of 42, thereabouts?
July of 1942.
They held out against the Japanese until July.
I think it was either June or July, and then Corregidor was 1 month later. But it's a large landmass that sits at the front of Manila Harbor in the Philippines.
I have visited it. Have you?
No.
Well, I once did a week's lectures at the University of the Philippines, and it's a tourist location, obviously. I went out and took a look at it.
And then the Corregidor Island, which sits off of the Bataan Peninsula. Yeah. So it was a major situation of the American resistance to the Japanese invasion of the Philippines. As you remember back, we heard the attack on Pearl Harbor the same day, December 8th, by the time clocks of the Far East. Manila was attacked simultaneously. So the Philippines fell very rapidly within 6 months. This is the last holdout, Bataan and then Corregidor. And what we have here...
When Douglas MacArthur said, "I shall return," that was the location to which he was going to return.
He was going to return to Luzon, the main island in the Philippines. And we have, in this particular recording, the shortwave broadcast by a soldier from Brooklyn, who is sitting there with his buddies, and they're exhausted, they're out of ammunition, and they're waiting for the Japanese to grab them. They don't know if they're going to be killed or what would happen to them. We know the Bataan death march is what will happen to many of them, where they'll be marched across the land and collapse and die on the way. But the there is a man who is a voice who is translating what is being tapped out. But if you want to get the sense of the agony of what an uncertain future, immediate uncertain future, listen to this cut that American listeners heard in 1942.
The white flag is up. Everyone is bawling like a baby. They're piling dead, wounded soldiers in our tunnel. I'm vomiting. Arms weak from pounding key long hours. No rest. Short rations. Tired. I know now how a mouse feels. Caught in a trap. Waiting for guys to come along. Finish it up. Got a treat. Canned pineapple. Opening it with Signal Corps knife. My name, Irving Strobing. Get this to my mother. Mrs. Minnie Strobing. 605 Barbie Street, Brooklyn, New York. They are to get along okay.
By golly. Now, is that a real-time event or is that a reenactment?
As far as I know, it's not a reenactment. It's a real-time event.
And that is
picked up. And then it
startling.
Would have been, you know, they would have then used the recording with the translator under it. It is. I mean, he gives his mother's address in Brooklyn, the street address, and it's just a...
The street is in Brooklyn Heights. I know that neighborhood.
You do? Yeah. Okay. Did you know the Strobing family at all?
No. Okay.
And I've always wondered whatever happened to Mr. Strobing.
Yeah.
And it was a very, very brutal beginning.
Well, the loss was very, very high.
The loss was high. And you can imagine everything seemed to be... By this time, in mid-42, the Japanese have taken...
over Thailand. They've taken over Indochina. They've taken over the Dutch East Indies. They've been stopped in their move toward taking over Australia. But that's not rewarding as much as the Battle of Midway in the same period, June of 1942, is as far as close to the United States as the Japanese would ever come again, as they were stopped in a brutal several-day encounter, and their ships were sent back to Japan. And after that, it was pushing back in the Pacific against Japan and in North Africa and then up through Europe in the European theater.
What's the consensus from the military historians? You're not a military historian, but I know you read them, and you've looked very deeply into the whole history of World War II. What's their consensus as to whether our victory was inevitable and was bound to happen, though it took a lot of effort, took a lot of materiel, took a fair amount of sacrifice? Or was it at some point, as Nelson said of his victory what's the victory in which they dispatch Napoleon? Waterloo. Nelson says of his victory at Waterloo, it was a damned close-run thing. Might have happened otherwise. How does one think about World War II in that connection?
The Germans, for instance, they really downplayed and never thought that much of the American character of the American people. They really figured the Americans were not – they had a second-rate army. They had been used to fighting little skirmish wars or invading little Latin American countries to get their way. And they
That's the German view of our army.
The German, yeah. Yes. And the German ambassador would write back dispatches saying, you know, don't worry about the Americans. They're not a power. We can easily overtake them. And on top of that, they have internal dissensions that'll keep them divided. So the Germans thought they could. But once the Americans gelled, it was obvious that the capacity to produce and the manpower and womanpower available in this country was not infinite, but so much greater than what the Germans had and could have, that it was inevitable. And in fact, once they stopped the Japanese and once they turned the German tide in North Africa, it's just, you know, a matter of time. It's a lot of blood and a lot of work and a lot of years, but it's just march on, push them back. Maybe, you know, one step backwards, two or three steps forward, so that it's the Americans that are the difference, because the French and the what there were of them left, because they were pretty much conquered, and the British with their imperial troops, they had enough perhaps to stalemate for a long time. But with the American involvement, as it was in World War I, once the Americans came in, they tilted the balance in favor of the British.
But one has to put into that same general analysis, of course, the tremendous losses of the Germans on the Eastern Front, and the losses that the Soviet Union sustained. Some your estimates of something like 20 million people.
20 in one war, as well as, you know, tens of millions, in over 10 million, rather, in World War I. But the Russians were a major ally of the United States. They pushed the German Eastern Front back by themselves. And
when we did the D-Day invasion, three-quarters of the Soviet, of the German army, was on the Eastern Front.
Exactly. And that's why even then the D-Day invasion was tough. But it's the Americans who really make the difference, because the Germans have to fight the Americans. In North Africa, they have to have manpower. They have to fight them in Italy. When the Italians collapse in September of 43, the Germans have to come in and occupy Italy and fight the Americans to more or less a draw north of Florence. And the Germans are the ones who are fighting in France when the American armies land in Nice and in the Riviera and march up that way. And it's the Germans who are doing the fighting of the Americans and the Canadians and the British when they land in Normandy and the various beaches.
This is Memorial Day, and we're memorializing, we're remembering American military who sacrificed so much, and over 400,000 men, I suppose some women as well, killed in battle.
Yes.
What's the total number of people destroyed by World War II, world over?
World over. Oh, my Lord.
I've heard estimates like between 50 to 60 million.
I would guess 50 to 60. That sounds normal. If you give the Russians 20 right there, the Americans lost 600,000. The British lost how many? But then you add all the other nations, the Indians, the Chinese.
I have to remember all of those. Slaughtered in the extermination camps by
the Jews,
by the Germans,
of course, and the Slavs and the Gypsies, and of course the Chinese were destroyed by the Japanese for almost 10 years. If you start the invasion of China in 1936, so that it's just the it is the result of the collapse of the organizing principles of the world that had existed up to World War One, and then, in the words of the great Spanish critic Ortega Gasset, it is the rise of the masses, and you get lumpen proletariats like a little creep like Hitler, who comes up and articulates this rage of the ignorant in power. It's what was Mussolini? He was a corporal in the Italian army. That's all.
Oh, but he was an intellectual. He was a socialist intellectual.
Well, I don't know how intellectual.
Newspaper editor.
Yeah.
Who then switched from socialism to
National socialism, basically.
Well, to fascism, which he helped to invent. Fascinating times. It was a sort of a slum of a century, as somebody called it, the 20th century.
It was, till we come back. And hopefully we have reached a point where those kind of tribal hatreds that are the European wars have reached an integrating point. And hopefully the euro survives and Europe melds into a United States.
And hopefully we are not too late as we catch up with our commercial schedule and then directly back. Later on, we will be taking a few phone calls. We're opening the lines right now. The number, of course, 312-591-7200. We won't get onto the calls for another perhaps 20 minutes. All the same, if you don't mind waiting, get in there. 312-591-7200 for email, wherever you're located. If you want to reach us through that modality, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And we pause right now for a quick round of commercials.
There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. I want to be their boy, spread some joy when they take old Berlin. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin.
Well, Bing is bouncing away, looking forward to this, but it wasn't quite all that easy a job.
It wasn't that easy, and it wasn't that quick. But they eventually did go marching in 1945.
It begins with D-Day. Of course, earlier it began with the Italian campaign, to be sure, and the North African campaign before that. But the big event leading towards Berlin is the landings at Omaha Beach and the other beaches on D-Day. What do we have here?
June the 6th, 1944. And it is the largest invasion in the history of the world. I have some statistics here.
Yeah.
10,000 airplanes, 800 naval guns, 80 warships, 4,000 transit ships, 450,000 vehicles, 2.2 million men involved from Britain, Canada, and the United States primarily. 4 million tons of stores were landed as the Americans, as the Allies breached the German lines in France and began to move toward Germany through France, liberating Paris, and moving toward the Ruhr and into Germany.
What do we have from radio of that day?
There was expectation that an invasion was coming, but nobody knew when. And this is the first reports that are confirmed by the U.S. government. The German broadcasts were picked up, but the Americans didn't know if the Germans were not faking us out by saying the invasion is taking place. But when the United States government confirms it here to CBS News, we begin to get the live coverage, not in the battle, but the live coverage on the air as radio takes the American listener along with it all the way through the war.
One of the great radio figures of that time, Robert Trout, who lasted on beyond the war for another 30 years or so.
Oh, he was a long time.
and he's one of the major voices right here.
Supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters, the newsroom in New York. I've just taken the microphone out of the studio again and back into our news headquarters. You have just heard from London Colonel R. Ernest Dupuis of the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces reading communique number one. Everything to this point has been German reports, and communique number one now says, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. It is now official. The landings have begun. And at this moment, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
As you just heard from Mr. Trout, the period of doubt is at an end, and we have official announcement of the landing of Allied armies on the northern coast of France. As there's nothing to add to the very bare words of the official communique, it was to be expected that the Allied naval forces would cover the landing and would be engaged in conveying our troops to the coast of France, and that there would be strong air support. When there's any further details to give you, we will bring them to you promptly, and we'll try to analyze them for you as well as we can within the limits of the information that we get from time to time. Now, here again is Mr. Trout.
Major George Fielding Elliott has been speaking to you, talking about the invasion, I think we can now call it that, following the reading of the first communique number one from SHAEF, that's what we call Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, somewhere in Great Britain.
That's superb material.
Those recordings are in excellent shape. They run 6 or 8 hours to the CBS coverage, and it exists, and it is compelling. No matter where you drop in, you're in the middle of the most historic event of one of the most historic events of the first half of the 20th century.
The D-Day date is June 6th, and when do we reach Berlin?
You don't reach Berlin until April of 1945.
Yeah.
And there it's who's going to get there first, the Russians or the Americans? And the Russians get there first, and the Americans come later, come very shortly there.
It's hard to break out of Normandy, but eventually they do. But then the big setback that comes a few months later towards Christmas is the Battle of the Bulge.
December.
The last push by the Germans against us.
Yeah, the Americans, the Allies, became a little too confident, a little overextended. They got there too fast. It looked too easy. And the Germans had a counteroffensive and pushed them back and at bulge in their lines they created. But that lasted only a couple of weeks. It was a bloody battle, but with the collapse of the German counteroffensive, the Americans crossed the Ruhr, crossed the Rhine River, and were into the German territory and into Cologne. And cities like that begin to fall, and Berlin is the last place.
A quick stop for an update on the news, and then back to some of this recording material, but shortly on to some of your calls as well. 312-591-7200, the number, and to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
So they've given up. They're finally done in, and the rat is dead in an alley back of the Wilhelmstrasse. Take a bow, G.I. Take a bow, little guy. The Superman of tomorrow lies dead at the feet of you common men of this afternoon. This is it, kid. This is the day. All the way from Newburyport to Vladivostok. You had what it took and you gave it. And each of you has a hunk of rainbow round your helmet. Seems like free men have done it again. Is victory a sweet dish or isn't it? And how do you think those lights look in Europe after 5 years of blackout going on to
Now that's another Corwin script.
Oh, that's Norman Corwin at his greatest. Yeah. Such a powerful VE Day, May 1945. The Germans have surrendered. The war in Europe is over. And this is him saying, you little guy, they thought you were weak and you stood up to the bully boys and you beat them down and destroyed them. But the war wasn't over.
We still had Japan to deal with, and that one was ended with a decision that still resonates with some conflict, according to some observers, namely the decision to use what we then called the atom bomb on a Japanese city, Hiroshima, and then to do it a second time around for Nagasaki.
It was controversial because it represents such a quantum, no pun intended, with Einstein, but a quantum leap into a new world of mass destruction such minimal weaponry. But the alternative, and Harry Truman defended it, was a land invasion of Japan. They had destroyed the Japanese Navy. They had destroyed the Japanese Air Force, but they hadn't destroyed the will of the Japanese people.
Before they dropped the bomb, Harry Truman goes to Potsdam, a suburb of Berlin, to meet with Churchill and with Stalin. And is de Gaulle there as well? I'm not sure. I think he's not.
No. And then Churchill lost his election and Clement Attlee.
In the middle of the conference, Churchill loses his election. And so Clement Attlee replaces him as prime minister. And all the while, Truman knows that he's got this weapon, probably. And Stalin knows that he's got this weapon as well.
But Truman never knew with absolute certainty that it would work. And if they dropped it and it was a dud, that would have been terrible.
But they do drop it, and at the Potsdam Conference, they gave surrender terms to Japan, which was essentially unconditional surrender.
Absolute, unconditional.
And a few days after the dropping of the two nuclear weapons, we get capitulation by Japan. Here is H.V. Kaltenborn. Who was he?
H.V. Kaltenborn was the premier newsman on NBC Radio and had been around since worked on the Brooklyn Eagle back in the newspaper back in 1920s. So he had a very distinguished voice. He's probably most famous for having said, you know, that Dewey was going to win that when the votes come in from the countryside, Dewey will be elected president over Truman. He was wrong.
He had a rather British actor sound almost.
With a high nasal voice that cut beautifully through the early radio equipment.
And here he is telling us about the Japanese surrender. Here, thus the true end at last of the war.
You can say it with emphasis, but it's ringing in millions of hearts all over the world tonight. That's glad, glad news that we've been waiting for years. And here it is. Sometimes it hardly seems for a moment that it can be true. We've become so immersed in war. We have lived the war so completely, so intensely, that this transition from one moment to the next into peace seems almost impossible to realize. And yet, we know it's true. We know that the President of the United States has told us that it was true. And here is what he said. The words deserve repeating again and again. I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender. Great Britain, Russia, and China will be represented by high-ranking officers. Meantime, the Allied Armed Forces have been ordered to suspend offensive action. The proclamation of VJ Day must wait upon the formal signing of the surrender terms by Japan. Following is the Japanese government's message, accepting our terms.
This was August 14th, the Japanese accepting terms on September the 2nd, 1945, aboard the battleship Missouri, which the radio announcers describe as a piece of American territory, a small piece of American territory in Tokyo Harbor. The Japanese signed the formal surrender documents. The war on both sides now was over in Europe
and in East Asia.
We're going to commemorate the end of the war with a particular musical selection, and giving credit to yet another noble companion in the war, namely Winston Churchill, who we barely mentioned, except we have just said that, of course, he was there at Potsdam. On our playlist, the Churchill March, number 17. And this will take the full march, a martial tune to round it out, then some commercials, and then on to the phone calls. 312-591-7200 is how you reach us. Get your calls in right now if you want to raise a question, offer a thought. Indeed, if you're old enough and are somehow someone who lived through those years and has a childhood memory of them, we'd love to hear from you as well. The lines are open, 312-591-7200, in celebration of the end of the war, the Churchill March. As we fade the Churchill March, which neither of us has ever heard, it sounds like a symphonic march, I was just attracted by the fact that Churchill is in the title. And indeed, we've done interesting programs about Churchill, often particularly about, so many different programs about Churchill. And we've focused on the American end of the war, thus we haven't played any of the great speeches by Churchill or even by FDR. And there's the horrific speeches by Hitler, of which there are quite a number.
You don't have to know German to be turned off by Hitler. Yeah. Just listen to the maniacal syntax and the rhythm and the tone. It's terrifying language.
We are about to pause for our last round of commercials and then directly on to the calls. I see all the lines are taken. If you're trying to reach us and not getting through, don't be discouraged. Just call again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. We'll be on to the first call after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And now directly back to Fred MacDonald, our very special guest for the evening, our guide through the radio history of the American side of World War II, and on to your calls to him at 312-591-7200. And Frank has reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Yes, this is Frank. I had three cousins in the war. The one, probably the most dangerous, that was Thomas Rebel in the B-29 and B-17s over Japan twice. He bombed Tokyo, once Yokohama, and once Kobe. And after Kobe, his plane was hit, but he got his B-29 back to Guam. And my other cousins, Edward was in the Caribbean with the Navy, and he did sink German U-boat off the waters in Cuba. And the third cousin was a CB, Wallace Hederman. He was shot at, and his tractor was hit a couple of times.
I'm sure that if you scratch any American family to any depth at all, you find war casualties.
War casualties, war experiences, and good, but also personally, very privately, terrifying memories also.
Sure. 312-591-7200. Our thanks to that first caller. Next up is David. Good evening, sir.
How are you doing?
Fine. Go ahead, please.
Yes. My family is long on history in military service. Actually, it goes back to the Civil War, but more recently, my father was in Korea. He was shot twice. I was in the Navy, and I don't know why, but I just, my term in the States, but my son is halfway through a 25-year career in the Army. He served twice in Iraq. He's also served in Haiti. He's done search and rescue for both of the hurricanes this year, and he's been on assignment twice with the DEA in the Arizona desert. But
you're the sort of fellow to whom one says thanks very much for your service. And thanks to your whole family, surely.
He had a unique thing happen to him last year at the Memorial Day service in Birmingham. A lieutenant who's never been deployed right out of the academy was really impressed by all the decorations on his uniform, and he wanted to know how could he get uniforms that look like that. And my son was somewhat set back that he would even ask the question. And he said, "Lieutenant," he said, "we'd go in the men's room and change right now. I'll give you this uniform." He said, "All you got to do is tell me one thing." And the lieutenant said, "What?" And he said, "You tell me how I could turn back the clock and be here for my daughter's first birthday instead of over there shooting and being shot at."
Uh-huh.
"You tell me how I could be here for my first anniversary when I was over there doing the same thing." He said, "And tell me how I could close my eyes without seeing the terror-stricken look of a man just before I put a bullet between his."
Oh, boy.
He said, "If you can take all of that away from me, Lieutenant, you can have this uniform." He said, "Lieutenant, freedom is not free." And I asked him what the lieutenant said, and he said, "Well, Dad," he didn't say anything. He stood and looked at me for a few seconds, and then he took two steps backwards, and he snapped to attention and saluted me, and he turned and quietly walked away.
That's a great story.
And that's a wonderful story, and a wise response by his
son. Yes, indeed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
Excellent and moving contribution. 312-591-7200. Jim is up next at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Yes, I remember that Sunday I was laying on the floor. I was 8 years old reading the comics from the Sunday paper from the Herald American. And I didn't fully understand, but it really came to, you know, to pass when we start having scrap drives, you know, at our grammar school. And we had pile. We'd go knocking on doors, and we had our little red wagon. We'd be hauling stuff in. We had a pile of scrap that had to be like six to eight feet high, you know. Besides the stamps, we'd buy war stamps. We, you know, kids couldn't afford bonds. We had the stamps, save the cans, you know, oleomargarine, the whole pack. Package, and it just made such an impression on me. Anytime there's anything on anywhere, you know, I'm just fascinated with it. Yeah,
it's a total war, and we have not had any experience in this country like it since or before. And I'm not so sure that that's not a good thing. But it was a total war that even children were part of the home front army.
I remember seeing the flags in the window with the stars, you know.
Yes.
Absolutely. One quick question, very quickly. Japan, how many did they lose?
I really don't have those statistics.
That's okay. That's not important, you know. But, hey, thanks for taking my call, guys.
We thank you, sir, for the call and for the memories. Interesting memories, indeed. 312-591-7200. And we go next to Brett at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. I was going to ask, I know Armed Forces Radio was very popular in the United States, isn't driving us to, you know, give full force and support to the Armed Forces. How much of the servicemen overseas actually did hear the broadcast from Armed Forces Radio? Because they were very famous people broadcasting on Armed Forces Radio, and I'm just wondering, you know, did the men in the trenches actually ever hear any of that?
Didn't you do virtually a whole book on that very matter?
No, not a book, but I have studied it, and indeed there were something like 79 or 80 transmission points around the world that broadcast for the Armed Forces Radio Service, AFRS. The Americans at home didn't hear those shows because they would have competed with network broadcasting, so they were exclusively for American soldiers and sailors around the world.
But you can hear them now, can't you?
Oh, yes.
How do you get that material?
Well, there are various places. Just go up on the internet and put up AFRS recordings, World War II, and you'll find lots of people who are selling them. They're very inexpensive. And you'll find lots of websites that have them up there for free, where you can download them yourself.
So actually, that's what I've been hearing then, is collected shows broadcast to the servicemen, not shows that were broadcast here in the United States.
No, they've been broadcast. Now, sometimes later on, the AFRS would pick up an American show like the, we'll say, Jack Benny show, and cut the commercials out of it and put it on a transcription disc and send it overseas for playing to an air base, a naval base, or soldiers in the field. And you know, you add to that, too, the motion picture industry sent motion pictures overseas. The Army, the Armed Forces made motion pictures. Frank Capra's famous Why We Fight series is a good example that were made for showing to recruits and showing around the planet. So you had the top people in American entertainment doing it for practically nothing.
Were the servicemen seeing and hearing all this?
Yes, absolutely.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
We thank you, sir. Well, you had that outfit called USO. I guess it still exists, doesn't it?
Well, that was a private organization that actually helped coordinate things for the soldiers at home.
Didn't they put on USO shows which toured abroad?
That's true. That's right. With people like, above all, Bob Hope.
But that's where Hope's great mission to the military began.
That began. His first one is in 1942. His first trip abroad with other Jerry Colonna, Francis Langford, and others.
Goodness, and it went on up to and including all of the Vietnam War.
Right. He was the Pentagon's favorite entertainer by far. But you had also a lot of domestic radio shows would be transmitted live from an Air Force base in California or Florida or North Carolina. So the integration of American entertainment, American popular culture into the entire war effort was fairly substantial. Nothing like today, where we can go about our everyday lives and have almost no thought about what's going on in Central Asia, unless, of course, we have a relative who is involved in Iraq or in Afghanistan or whatever. But back then, it was a total war. And if you want to know what the word means, it meant total. And that meant cultural as well as political as well as military.
And on to another caller. Gloria joins us. Good evening.
Hi there. You're making me stay up late tonight, but I wanted to listen to this. I was 14 and a couple of days after Pearl Harbor. So I remember all these things pretty well. And as he was saying, we were all so, you know, we were trying to do the best we could and stick up for America. And it was really interesting because we've had wars since that we don't get as involved personally. You know, we just thought everything was just great. I remember all those crazy songs we had and... The thing I remember most is I got sick. My dad was listening to the Chicago Bears on December 7th, and they announced that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And I said, "You really mean we're going to have a war?" You know, I didn't understand what that really was. But anyway, the next day I was sick with a cold, and my mother made me stay in bed for a while, and I laid there and listened to President Roosevelt declaring war. So it's something I'll never forget.
That would be a vivid memory, to be sure. Ma'am, thank you for the call. We're virtually out of time. Of course, that war was commonly known, or was it only later that the judgment was given by some historians and by some journalists, known as, quote, the Good War?
It was called, Studs Terkel used that term frequently to refer to
it. But ironically.
But yeah, of course, what war is good. But in terms of national sentiment in support of it,
yeah.
Certainly there were pacifists in this country who were not in favor of the war.
But there were no protests against the war as we had for all the other wars since that we've been involved in.
Well, none since then has ever been declared. And if they had been declared, that's against the law, a declared war, mm-hmm. to protest it. But there were no protests because it would have been illegal. But
yeah.
All wars thereafter have been not fully declared.
You're the master of radio archives. Just quickly, because only half a minute left, for those who want to pursue this further and find such material on the Internet, how would they go about it?
I would go to Google, write in radio shows, World War II, radio shows, whatever show you think of, and you will find people sell them. But as I said, you will also find websites where people enjoy putting them up for your enjoyment. And you can download them, play them, and listen to them.
Fred, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
This is probably the 12th or 15th, or maybe it's the 20th time we've done a radio retrospective. And it absolutely matches and equals the one that lives in my memory forever. You know which one that is?
Of course, I know which one that is. Vic and Sade.
We both were great Vic and Sade fans, and we once had a wonderful night playing old Vic and Sade, which is another story. And lots of people will wonder, what in the world was Vic and Sade? Look it up. Look it up on the Internet.
Right.
You can get a lot of free Vic and Sade programs. VIC and SADE. Vic and Sade. And with that, we will wind down for the evening with warm thanks to a very good friend, to Fred McDonald. And thanks to all for listening. And we will be with you again tomorrow with a one-hour program beginning at 11 p.m. Until then, a most cordial good night to all.